This is The Tiger Rag, one of Lee's favorite songs. I'm Shelley, one of Lee's six kids. Here's part two of the interview that Dean Porter and Dean's daughter, who's also named Shelley, did with Lee in the year 2000.
What's the most famous case you ever had, Lee?
Oh, Wilczek Dunham was one, and the American Salt case. That cost the company, to date, $80 million, and it still cost him out as plaintiff in that case.
Are they still paying on that?
Oh, they'll be paying for the next 200 years, the cleanup. But this was a case that for 100 years, the salt company had been polluting the underground aquifer at Lyons. You know where it was. And they had done it so long, they thought they had a prescriptive right to pollute. Obnoxious, overbearing, and the farmers complained about it. Cecil Miller, you probably knew Cecil at one time. But they came to see us, and Deborah, who worked with me at that time, came up with the idea of a abatable private nuisance. They could abate it at any time, and they could start the cleanup. You know, you spend enough money, $1 billion, you clean up anything. But as long as they did it, you could sue for damages each year. So we sued them on that basis and tried it before a judge who was a judge on the Karen Silkwood case. And he's Phi Beta Kappa, an environmentalist. But at any rate, it took us 8 years to get to court. And I just destroyed most of the records. Filing cases like this, there were over 50 of them, you can imagine. But at any rate, the General Host, the parent company, was headquartered in New York City. And one day, the general counsel asked leave of the court to introduce some home office lawyers that he had brought to trial. Now, they had six home office lawyers, and they had four from New York City, four from Philadelphia, and three from Wichita. Okay? He introduces all these home office and said these are all in-house counsel. And so I said, may I have clarification? Certainly. And I name them off individually. In-house counsel? Yes. Then I name off the New York lawyers, the Philadelphia lawyers, and Wichita lawyers. I presume then that these are all outhouse counsel. You know what he said? Yes. Judge you left see, the bench on that one.
Jim Harris and I were at that trial, one of the sessions. Yeah. And we knew you had it won when the jurors came out and winked at you. We knew you were going to win that one.
Well, I did it. Yeah, thank God to the judge, because I had forgotten when I was doing this that one of the judges on the Tenth Circuit, chief judge at that time, was a Mormon. And you know when you've got a case won. Well, the defendant brings in a guy. At that time, he was head of Chiquita Banana, American Standard Brands, a Harvard-trained lawyer. But he had been manager of American Salt 35 years before, and he recalled with great accuracy that they had a brown book that they kept in a locked safe, which had disappeared shortly after he left, on which was written all kinds of information helpful to American Salt. And he remembered exactly what was in the brown book. So in cross-examination, I go after his memory. 2 weeks out, zero. A week out, pretty poor. Everybody in the courtroom knew he was lying. So I ask him a question, and he starts ducking and dodging. I said, you must be a Mormon. All the lawyers are on their feet objecting. Objection! What does that have to do with the case? 13 lawyers for the defense. I said, Your Honor, I'll be glad to respond. Judge says, go ahead. I said, a number of years ago, I was asked to speak to the Salt Lake City Bar, or the Utah Bar at Salt Lake City. And one of the side benefits was that I got a private tour of the LDS facility there at Salt Lake. This is all true. I said, I was told that Joseph Smith was a farm boy who grew up near Elmira in New York. And one day when he's 14 years old, he's lolling under the trees, and he happens to look up, and sliding down on a shaft of light was the angel Moroni. And as Mo touched down, he noticed tucked under his arms were some golden tablets upon which was written in a strange language the Book of the Mormon. Joe was given the gift of translation, and from that we have the wonderful Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. I said, Your Honor, you'll have to admit that was an interesting story. So I asked the next logical question. The judge says, which was? I'd like to see him. See what? The golden tablets. I was told that they were not available, and the reason they weren't available, that immediately on translation, God sucked them back up to heaven to keep them from being profaned by the non-believers. I said, all I want to know, Your Honor, is that what happened to the Brown Book?
Lee, did you ever try any criminal cases?
One. Well, I defended a very large tax evasion suit, but one criminal case. I wasn't defending, I was plaintiff, prosecutor. I was asked to prosecute a case. this guy was a serial rapist at Great Bend. And he also had murdered the next door neighbor. But the judge ruled they couldn't prosecute it because they'd goofed up the investigation and evidence. Judge was wrong, but he wasn't prosecuted for it. And he always went after some woman that he worked with or knew. Like the next door neighbor, one of them, he asked to borrow a cup of sugar. Come on in. He produced a knife and so forth. And the woman he killed had the trailer house right next to his at the airport. And she went for her gun, and she ended up being shot 23 times. But in my case, girl worked where he did. He was married, was 19. She had a little house. She rented and had a dog there. And in the summer, she happened to wake up and put the dog out and goes back to bed. And here he is over her, and they have a fight, and he finally leaves. In November, at 3 o'clock in the morning, she hears a sound. It was a sound of the glass breaking in the kitchen. And by the time she gets to the bedroom door, here is a masked man, ski mask, gloves, totally covered, with a knife. And he takes off her glasses and throws them in a corner, beats her unconscious, and rapes her. Beats her. Oh, horrible. And takes her billfold. Well, the next Monday, she sees him at work, and she says, you did it. She had two black eyes, looked like hell. But no evidence. And everybody knew that this guy had murdered this woman. Well, the attorney general asked me to prosecute it because it was a very difficult case, and the county commissioners asked me to prosecute it, so I took on prosecution. Hanks was his name. I try it one time, convict him. Judge sets it aside, one of his instructions. Wrong. We had a very liberal, still do, a very liberal judge, Democrat. So we try it a second time. He sets aside the verdict against this guy because he thought my argument was too strong. I told the jury that we don't have the option anymore of taking a red-hot branding iron, branding R for rapist, on their forehead so girls and women could see what's coming down the street. Just convict him and we'll take it from there. Thought that was too strong. Third time, convict him again. This time, there was an issue whether he had a beard or not under the mask. And they bring in the FBI agent who was on the Patty Hearst case,
yeah.
Who helped convict Patty Hearst. And frankly, I couldn't understand it. F. Lee Bailey is not a good lawyer, in my opinion. I've been on programs with him. F. Lee Bailey couldn't break through this guy's testimony. I had the jury laughing at him when he testified in this case. I had him laughing him right out of the courtroom. Well, the third time, I convicted him. The judge had to send him up. And what he was a psychopath. And I was so appalled at where criminal law has gone because judge got his arm around this criminal all through the trial. Judge knew about the murder that I set up a criminal justice program at the junior college. And I put in, I think, over 100,000. And I've given a lot. I set up a video program, and I've spent a lot of money on it because I truly was appalled where law has gone on criminal matters. Everything's stacked in favor of the criminal defendant.
When do you think that changed?
With the Warren Court back in Eisenhower's time. Yeah, society, if you've ever read Thomas Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes says that people, state of nature, state of war, so they make a deal with the strongest to make him king, if you will, in return for creating equal justice under law for everybody else and protect the citizens. Now, if the king cannot do that, then the people have a right, it's called the social contract, to rebel and kick the king out and establish a new government. And it's real simple. If any government fails to provide equal safety of the people, it becomes illegitimate. And the United States has come very close to that point because most big cities, it's very dangerous, and people live in fear all their life. A government must provide for the safety of its people.
Lee, you have to go.
No, not yet. Not yet. I've got 45 minutes.
45 minutes?
Yeah, before I have to be there.
Oh, I thought it was 11:30.
No, it's 11. Oh, God, you're right. No, this is Colorado time.
Yeah. Oh, I got my time.
Yeah, I do that. I was in Kansas, and I thought maybe I'd say.
Oh, yeah, we got time.
Okay, keep going.
Steve has got a question for you.
All right.
What are your views on today's regarding trial lawyers?
Very few trial lawyers. Firms 400 and 500 men do not have trial lawyers. State Farm's principal counsel in Bloomington, they use Chicago firm because the head of State Farm's legal department comes from that firm. And they have about 350 lawyers. They do not have a trial lawyer. Very few good trial lawyers in the country. Now, there's lots of litigators. A litigator is someone who you put in a room and they churn out paper, interrogatories, briefs, motions, and so forth. But they never go to trial. Litigators. The biggest insult you can ever make to a trial lawyer is call him a litigator. Now, for example, your Texaco case, Pennzoil Texaco, and $2 billion verdict, Joe Jamail is a trial lawyer. vulgar man. Incidentally, he had given the judge that heard the case $200,000 in campaign contributions 2 years before the trial. Both of them were Lebanese or Syrians. But he was trial lawyer. Texaco's lawyers were corporate lawyer litigators. They were not trial lawyers. And Joe Jamail kicked the living daylights out of him. A trial lawyer is someone who goes to trial, goes to before juries, and tries the case out to its conclusion. Litigator, you churn out paper. And that's what a kid gets out of Harvard, first, second, or third in his class, becomes a litigator. But I guarantee you, he'll be lucky in his whole lifetime if he tries five cases. Does that tell you the difference?
Yeah. Would Racehorse Haynes, what's his name down
there? Racehorse Haynes.
Racehorse, is he a trial lawyer?
Limited. He hadn't tried a lot of cases, but he's done well when he tries them. John Shepard, who was president of the American Bar, tells me a wonderful story about Racehorse Haynes. Shepard is doing defense work. He's dead now. But they were trying, due to try a case, lawnmower case, I think, federal court at Topeka for Judge Templar. Most federal judges are sticklers for time and the dignity of their office. Okay, court was supposed to start at 9 o'clock. Well, Racehorse Haynes gets to the courthouse and hears all the news media, because Racehorse is famous. And so he's giving interviews to them. And 9 o'clock comes and goes, and judge comes in. There's Shepard, and judge says, "Where's Mr. Haynes?" And John says, "Well, if it please the court." He says, "As your honor knows," he says, "Mr. Racehorse Haynes is very famous." And he says, "As a matter of fact, he's out to giving interviews on the steps to the news media. And as soon as they finish with him, I'm sure he'll be in here. And we all have to understand, we just have to wait for him." Now, here's a federal judge. Didn't want to wait for anybody.
No.
And so he starts to fly into a rage and flounces back into chambers. And, of course, when Haynes finally appears, he's in big trouble. And it followed him all through the case. Racehorse Haynes.
Now, F. Lee Bailey says that he never made any money, or very little money, defending people. He said he had a $1 million case, but he never collected it. He said it always kind of cost him money. I wonder, where does all his money come from?
It comes from defense. Maybe I told you this story. I was on a program in Toronto, Kansas, a mock trial. And one of our participants was Attorney General of England, who later became Lord Chief Justice of England. Did you ever see Chariots of Fire, the movie?
Yes, sir.
Remember the blonde aristocrat runner?
Mm-hmm.
That was Haver's son. Incidentally, he died of AIDS. But at any rate, Haver's was on the program, and F. Lee Bailey was on the program. And F. Lee Bailey is pretty good in a set speech. In a fluid trial situation, he's not mentally fast at all, and really wasn't worth a damn, in my opinion. But anyway, one night, let's see, Bailey and his staying with what we thought was his wife across the hall from us. Betsy had been talking about going back for an advanced degree for years. Going to go back and get a master's. And so we're out to dinner with Havers and his wife and Ian Outerbridge, president of the bar in Canada, and his wife, Pat, who's a good friend of ours, and Betsy and me and F. Lee Bailey. And in the course of the evening, it became obvious that she was not his wife. So as we break up, Pat looks at Betsy and says, "I don't think that's his wife, Betsy." And Betsy says, "Do you suppose there really is a Mrs. F. Lee Bailey?" And I said, "Of course there is, Betsy." I says, "But she's out getting an advanced degree, and it's okay." I never heard another word about an advanced degree. You think that's terrible, don't you? Never heard another word about an advanced degree.
Steve has another question he wants to ask you.
Okay.
The truth or relative to the practice of law and the shaping of American culture.
Well, that sounds character like a Henry Still Commager type of question. Brings me back to a philosophy of life. I think that the well-lived life is a search for truth. I was asked about 6 years ago to meet with what they call a Japanese treasure. Itokawa was his name. Itokawa was in his 80s and had a resume about 18 inches thick. Itokawa was head of the design team that designed the Japanese Zero. In 47, 48, he was in the United States, and he bought a little transistor radio, took it back and gave it to a friend of his and said, "This might be of interest to you. Maybe you do something with this." And his friend thanked him kindly. And his friend was Morita of Sony, who was a very close friend of his. But at any rate, we talk about everything under the sun. I spent about, Morita, Nomura Securities asked me to be there. I spent about 6 hours with him. We talked about everything under the sun. He agreed that dropping the bomb saved millions of Japanese lives and American lives. He said the military was so strong that they would never give up. And he says, America, he says, they say would have lost 300,000 lives. He says you would have lost closer to 3 million. He says the whole nation was prepared to fight to the death. Then we talked about, dropping the bomb was the thing. Then we talked about why did the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor and start the war? And he said, 553. Remember, I taught history. I said, 553. I said, "Are you talking about the Washington Naval Disarmament Treaty of 1921? He said, "Yes. This is something you'll want to know." And I says, "How was that?" He says, "We beat the Russians in 1905, 1906. We were on the winning side in World War I. Then the United States and Britain forced us to agree." And he says, "Britain and the United States, which are one, forced us to agree 5 tons naval armament for U.S., 5 tons for Britain, 3 tons for Japan. 5 and 5 is 10. They get 10, we get 3. They're out to destroy Japan." Now, he says, from 1921 through World War II, 1 hour a day was spent in every Japanese classroom on the subject of 553 and how the United States and Britain are out to destroy Japan. And we never knew that.
If we'd known it, we'd have known war was inevitable. Then we talk about other things, religion. He says, Japan will stay on top for no longer than 20 years. I said, why not? He says, all Japan believes in is material things. He says, a great nation has to believe in something bigger than itself for it to remain on top. And he says, Japanese Shinto is dead, Buddhism's dead. He says, I have researched all the world's religions, and I have found that Judaism comes closest to approximating the Japanese character. And he says, if I can live another 10 years, I will have established the seeds of Judaism as a new religion for Japan. And I said, in my opinion, the only true religion is seeking after the truth. Every great religious leader has always said the same thing. Man on a mountaintop seeking God without the intervention of any organized church, because most of the churches at the time they arise are corrupt. He says, us so. He says, in that context, who is the most religious man in the world? I said, that's easy. He says, who? I said, Stephen Hawking. He says, us so. I agree. You know who Stephen Hawking is? Because here's a guy totally paralyzed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, can't even speak. They have to use an amplifier. But his mind is superb, and he is seeking the truth. And I don't care what you do in life, if that's the program for you, trying to seek the right answer, always seek the right answer and follow the right answer, you're not going to go wrong. Seeking after the truth. Now, one of the problems with organized religion is everybody says your search for truth is over. You crawl into our box, and all the truth you ever need to know is contained in this box. And incidentally, if you try to come out of the box, we'll knock your damn head off. Because Toynbee, for example, says that the core around which civilizations are built in their dying phases, new civilization rising, is a new religion, which is a higher concept than what's gone beyond before. For example, you had all the gods involved in Mediterranean culture, in Greece and so forth, multiple gods, sort of tribal deities. You start out. First religion was metamorphosis. Everything had a spirit in it. The spirit of the rock, spirit of the tree, spirit of the saber-toothed tiger, and so forth. Then, as thinking developed, you have fire worship. And then after that, you have sun worship. Incidentally, you know what we celebrate at Christmas? What do you think? Now, you're Southern Baptist. What do you think?
Of course, I don't want to say the traditional answer.
But what do you think?
The birth of Jesus?
No. He was born in April. What do you think you're really celebrating?
Was that when the Magi saw the star and decided to go?
No.
Well, tell me before.
Well, I'm just holding my breath, waiting for you to ask me to tell you why. sun worship. When you worship the sun as the source of all life, that's pretty advanced, isn't it? Ahura Mazda of Persia, the worship of the sun. Baal, you know who Baal was?
He's a Babylonian god.
He's a god. Babylon.
So he's a sun god.
Yeah.
Baal was a sun god.
Yeah.
All over the world, they worship the sun, particularly in the northern hemisphere. Now, as you worship the sun, as you pass the summer, the sun is losing its power, isn't it? Now, the priests always, have you ever wondered why in early civilizations the priests were always great astronomers? They are, you know, whether it's pre-Columbian or anywhere in the world. The reason is, if they understand and can predict astronomical phenomena, they can make the people think they control it. Keep the people in ignorance and they control it. Okay, now, as you approach December the 21st, they are sacrificing this, that, and the other. But all over the world, on December the 21st, the priest said, we've tried everything. The only thing that can save us from the powers of darkness overcoming the power of light is to sacrifice our most precious possession. And guess who that is? the warrior king. All over the world, they put the warrior king to death on December 21st. Now, it took 4 days to see whether it worked or not. But in 4 days, you could see the sun was starting to move back to the north. So then they have a tremendous celebration to celebrate the victory of light over darkness. Now, kings didn't like that a hell of a whole lot. So they developed the idea of vicarious sacrifice. There was a king in Sweden that prolonged his rule in the 13th century 28 years because he sacrificed a son every year instead of himself. Well, after a while, then they go to even more vicarious sacrifice. Slaves captured in battle would be sacrificed. Then ultimately you move into animal sacrifice. Now, for example, when Agamemnon wanted to get favorable winds to sail to Troy, he sacrificed his daughter, which made his wife kind of unhappy, and she and her boyfriend plotted to get even with him. So when he came home from the Trojan Wars, went through the Lion Gate, they murdered him. Well, that didn't make his son very happy, Orestes. So Orestes figured out that Mama and her boyfriend did it and killed them. And then he was pursued by the Furies because you shouldn't kill your mama. Have you ever heard of Santorini, supposedly the source of Atlantis? Santorini is halfway between Greece and Crete. Crete was a dominant power for almost 1,000 years. When it fell apart, then Greece emerged. Well, anyway, 1623 B.C., Santorini blew 6,000 feet of mountain off in a 6,000-foot hole in the ocean floor. The tidal wave was over 500 feet high when it hit Crete. But in Crete, there's little temples at that time that the earthquakes that preceded the volcanic blow-up, eruption, they find young men laid out on altars that had just been put to death to try to sacrifice to keep the earthquakes from stopping. And remember what Abraham was going to do to Isaac?
Sacrifice him.
Yeah, and that was on the Dome of the Rock. Mm-hmm. Okay, now when Christianity becomes a state religion in Rome, everybody says, what are you going to do about Saturnalia? You can't take people's holiday away from them. And at think, somebody says, we'll celebrate the birth of Christ. He was born in April. That's okay. Give them their holiday and celebrate the birth of Christ and everything's going to be okay. And that's why you celebrate at that time.
Where'd you read that?
Golden Bough. You'll need to read that. What do you think the Christmas tree comes from? And why?
I have no idea.
It's a symbol of life, isn't it? It's green in the winter. That's Druid.
Mm-hmm.
That's the pagan custom of the Druids. They bring the Christmas tree inside. There is a reason for everything.
Mm-hmm.
In a search for truth, you should never be ashamed of what you find in the search for truth.
Steve's got another question.
Okay.
What are your greatest concerns for yourself, your family, your profession, and your country?
Hmm. Okay, the profession. Law is becoming a business, not a profession. It's becoming enormously expensive. Every time we have a legal or judicial reform, it doubles the cost of litigation. And the cost is so great now that people can't afford it. For example, we defend bad baby cases all over the United States, you know, cases born with brain damage. And that leads to lawsuits. And the cost of defending a bad baby case is $500,000. That's the average. Now, if you don't defend them properly, you get $15 million verdicts. And that's not good. And you always find some doctor for a series of doctors, if you pay him enough, going to come in and testify. It's the OB-GYN that delivered the baby, his fault that you had the brain damage. Law is judicial pressure, legal pressure, is becoming so expensive it's unreal. People simply can't afford it. Now in the country, see, I believe, this is kind of a Toynbean concept, but Gibbons and the others believe the same thing, too, is that life is a series of challenges and responses. And as long as you can respond to a challenge, you grow and you expand. Whether you're a nation, a society, or an individual, challenge and response. But if you fail to respond and begin to break down, there's a series of rallies and responses, rallies. But ultimately, the whole thing crumbles and disappears, and something new takes its place. Now, in the United States, something that disturbs me enormously is the way we're going. Remember John Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you, but rather what you can do for your country? Okay, that was what, 35 years ago?
60, something? 40 years
40 ago. 40 years ago. Okay, what's this campaign all about? How Everybody's much? Promising people, if you vote for me, you'll get this, this, and this. Nobody's asking people to do a damn thing for the country. You understand what I'm saying? If this trend keeps up, the United States is not going to be on top very much longer. Because, first of all, it's going to break the bank. And second of all, when people look to Rome, Rome fell through internal pressures, not external pressures. When they had citizen armies, they were invincible. But pretty soon, people wanted the good life and didn't want to fight in the army, so then they hired mercenaries. And the mercenaries did all the work, German mercenaries. And then pretty soon, people don't want to work at all, work the fields, so they used slaves for that. And they took over Egypt to get the grain out of Egypt and so forth. And then eventually, people have got to be entertained because there's nothing else to do, and you have the Roman circus, which was totally degenerate. And Rome fell because people didn't want to fight for it anymore. Taxes became extraordinarily high. People would escape from Rome to keep from paying taxes, and the whole thing collapsed. And in the United States, I see trends that I think are enormously disturbing because we're looking to government to give us whatever we want without anything much in return. You see, Toynbee believes there's a creative minority never exceeding 3% that make all the advances in any society. Now, if you have that creative minority working, they drag along the rest of society in their wake, and the society advances and so forth. For example, electronics and all the things we're seeing from there seems to be the engine that drives the growth in the United States. Now, you know, 4 years ago, we were in China, and you look at China, and I'm here to tell you that I think China is going to become the dominant power in the world in the next 40 years. Why? Because people are all working. Education, for example. It's an enormous privilege to be educated in China. Here, kids look on it as a great burden. Like at college, TCU. I'll tell you what the proportion is because I taught. 3 to 5% are a joy to have, students, and you learn from them. Another 10 to 12% are going to make good grades because it's the thing to do. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are going to kind of float through college, learn as little as they can get by with, but hope to get a college degree. In China, the great thrust is education, education, education. Now, the very best of the best, and they test all the time, go to Beijing University. The best of Beijing University goes to MIT, Harvard, Stanford, all of our great colleges where they get advanced degrees, PhDs in the sciences. Unfortunately, 70% of them stay here, which is enormously beneficial to us. But most of those still have ties to China, India, or wherever they come from. As China prospers, probably more of them will go back to China. And if you go to any graduate school in the United States, you'll see on the graduate school campus in the sciences, Orientals dominating everything because American kids don't want to work that hard. And if you don't work hard, athletically, hell, in basketball, you know, here he was, he had a runt, but he was captain of KU's basketball team. And you had to work hard, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Paul Gallen required you to work hard, didn't he?
Mr. Yes. Turner, do you see... You see there being a reverse in that anytime soon? Do you see any hope that maybe, I don't know?
Well, generations are a funny thing. For example, on juries, When you're defending a case, beware of older people on a jury, 60, 65, 70, because they want something for nothing. And if they figure the money's there, they're willing to give huge sums of money, because that's the thing to do. Now, as we go down the age scale, you get kids in their 30s and 20s, and they're tighter than a drum, because they are. They have a different view about life. And one thing that's encouraging to me is that young people are working harder today than they have for a long time to succeed. It's become very competitive. I like those trends. If I'm defending a case today, I'll go for 20, 30-year-old, 40-year-olds, and I'll kick the older people off the jury.
So what's your greatest concern for your family?
Challenge and response.
Same thing.
The toughest thing in the world, Dean, is for people who make a lot of money and achieve, for their children to achieve. Because when it's given to you without working, you don't learn from it. It's corrupting. Rags to riches in three generations, it's a fact. And the toughest thing is to become elevated, but your family continue to be elevated. You follow me?
Sure.
Toughest thing, and we've got our kids are damn well motivated, but you wonder about the next generation, although I'm kind of encouraged in what I see on the next generation, like Shelley for you. Seeking after the truth is tough, and it requires hard work. And society today, particularly Western society, doesn't want to work that hard. When we were in China, I saw the whole world was moving their high-tech factories to China. The whole world. Europe is going to hollow out. And the United States were moving, but Japan's moving all their stuff over there, Taiwan, because you have an inexhaustible supply of very bright but cheap labor. And China's coming on strong.
Shelley?
Now, what's at risk that Steve wanted me to talk about?
Well, you want to know your profession. You already talked about that. You talked about your country and your family.
Yeah, I worry about the country. I really worry about the country because examine what Gore, who he's representing. He's representing core constituencies that want more for less. Mm-hmm. All of them.
He wants to know, where did you develop, or who helped you to develop, an appreciation for the virtues of wisdom, justice, fortitude, and temperance?
Well,
he considers you quite a man, Lee.
Well, I've always been. When I was in third grade, my teacher, Miss McPherson, said, if you finish your work, you can read anything you want to read the rest of the time. Took me to the Carnegie Library, got me a library card. And you know what? By 11 o'clock every morning, I'd finish all the work for the day, and I got to sit there and read books from that time on. And I got hooked on a guy named Henty, historical novels, well-written novels. I think he wrote over 300 books. For example, you'd follow a Southern boy in the Confederate Army leading up to such-and-such battle. And then another book would be devoted to a Union young soldier leading up the battle, same in European battles. I read every damn book he ever wrote. Reading, I still read an enormous amount. I read fast.
Do you read John Jakes?
No. Who's John Jakes?
He wrote the history of the United States. It's a
lot of people have written histories of the United States.
it's written in a third degree. This guy, it starts in England or in Europe, and he's a bastard son, and he comes to the United States, and it goes clear up to Roosevelt's time.
That's Henty, just like Henty.
Yeah.
His book's on that, except yeah. There's a tremendous number of books.
And the history department at the University of Kansas City says it's the best chronological history of the United States ever
written. I ought to read that. There's a guy named Brodel, B-R-A-U-D-E-L, and it's a worm's eye view of history. And he gets his history from account books of the great merchant bankers. And, for example, you harvest in the wild wheat, and let's say you get three or four kernels off of every seed you plant. That led to village culture, because they raised enough food that you could have a blacksmith, this, that, and the other. Then pretty soon they increase it to where you get six seeds back, and so you have a greater differentiation of culture. Today we plant one seed of corn, and we expect to get 600 seeds back. And you see, that's how culture develops, cities develop, specialization develops. As I look at my family tree, I paid no attention to do it myself, but others have. Most of my ancestors came over in the 1600s. But what you do, for example, the Turners in Virginia, you would have an ancestor with 5,000 acres, lots of slaves. But usually you had at least two wives. First wife dies in childbirth. Then you have a second set. And when you're a descendant of the second wife, pretty soon you have less and less land as more people proliferate. And finally you're given a grubstake and you move to Georgia, which my family did. And then I'm a product of a second wife in Georgia, which then moved to Texas in about 1835, around Dallas. And in those times, it's called primogeniture, the feudal system. The first son, the eldest son, got most of the money. But what you see is a dip of family fortunes goes down, goes up, goes down, goes up. And when it's down, that's when you have the incentive to work harder, to elevate yourself. Education and all the rest. It's a series of rhythms. You know, I've always had this feeling. Toynbee said, obviously, society is not organic, but it follows organic principles. Have you ever watched blackbirds flock by the millions?
Sure.
And fly by for 3 hours so close together that you can't understand how they don't run into each other? Okay, if you're scuba diving, you see that same thing in schools of fish. Now, recently, they have found that they have to move synchronized in such a manner as they don't run into each other, and that there is no accounting of the electrical reflex movements to account for how they can fail not to run into each other. And the theory is beginning to take hold now that when birds flock together, they form an organism with a centralized brain, if you will, that keeps everything working properly, just like the cells in your body do. The same thing with schools of fish. I personally think that somehow when societies form, same thing happens.
Same thing with geese, huh?
Same thing happens, yeah. I think you're going to find, for example, you know, the guy that discovered the Titanic. Recently, he was over in the Black Sea. Now, 9,000 years ago, the Mediterranean broke the land bridge between the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. And so you have a tremendous amount of water pouring into what was then the Black Sea. He has found, I saw him on TV, houses, remains of houses, you know, the rafters, look just like you're building a house today, 300 feet down under the water, dating back before 9,000 B.C. Now, nobody dreamed that culture was that sophisticated back then. You go over to Santorini, my next-door neighbor at Hana, you know, the guy that sold Neutrogena for $1 billion. He's helped finance the dig at Santorini. Now, this is over 4,000 years ago, almost 4,000 years ago. They had hot and cold running water, sewer system, and the houses looked just like Greek houses today, two-story affairs. I mean, things are a lot older and have been around a lot longer than anybody ever dreamed of. Back to the United States.
I think education. We've somehow got to get people interested in becoming truly educated people. Because that's the only solution if we're going to stay on top of the world. It's for a lot more people to become educated and learn and understand.
What do you think? Like, you say truly educated. I mean, what do you mean? Like, beyond simple things or into more...
Oh, I believe education never ends.
Right.
Yeah, here's Dean and I. Well, I'm 73 and you're...
75.
75. I'm as interested in learning now as I was when I was 7 years old. And one of the things that you kind of feel bad about is you're limited on what you're going to see come to pass. That book I showed you by Kekku, you want to read it, about what's going to happen in the world. I think it's an exciting time to live. And I suppose in the overall scheme of things, it's really not all that important whether China is dominant or we're dominant or someone else is dominant. What's interesting is the ongoing search for answers and truth. That's what's interesting.
Is that the element of education you think is most important?
Well, that applies to every sciences, to art, to anything, is trying to find the answers. Why?
Search for knowledge.
Look at the physicists today. They are so close to a unified theory of matter. They're looking to prove the existence of what they call the boson. And when they do, they've unified everything. And they understand that matter. For example, the human genome. That's fabulous. Now, it's going to be a lot of work going to individuals and so forth, but it's a tremendous advance forward in life. Now, it's got a lot of perils, because we're going to be able to clone people.
Yeah.
We're going to be able to develop a super race if you're so inclined. United States, we say, we'll never do it. But I'll tell you, there's other countries that are going to do it. And so those are challenges. How do you handle that? It's, but... If people say we'll pass laws, that can be done. It's ridiculous because you can't stop knowledge with laws. Okay, I've got to go.
Well, now this afternoon we want
to... I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you the car. We'll go down to Rotary. I'll give you the car. Pick me up shortly after 1 o'clock.
All right. Okay.
We're through.
This concludes part 2 of Dean Porter's interview with Lee, which they did in the year 2000. Part 3 of this interview is on CD number 3.